Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
Okay.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Good morning and welcome to First Things First. I'm Jenna Wolf. That is Nick Wright. Danny Cannell joining us this morning. Got the turtleneck going. That's
cold
a staple
outside,
with
man.
You. Maybe it's cold.
On Friday, I got to break out the turtleneck. Come on. You saw Kristaps wearing it last night. Hey, it's going.
And look at the reception he got. So I'm just letting you know.
Right.
I'm not sure if it was the turtleneck or the play. Hey, it took us 5 days, but we made it to Friday. And after last night's football game, I, Jenna Wolf, can tell you one thing. Even when the Browns win, they still lose. Thursday night football, we're going to dive right in. It'll be the story everyone's talking about today, Steelers and Browns, and by far the ugliest game of the season with the Browns up 21-7 and the game coming to a close. Mason Rudolph, Steelers quarterback, and Myles Garrett from the Browns get into a scuffle in the end zone. So watch this. Garrett will rip off Rudolph's helmet, strike him in the head with it. Mason Rudolph can't even believe it. Benches would clear. An all-out brawl would ensue. So Garrett and two others would be ejected. An absolutely inexcusable finish in which suspensions will most certainly be handed down. For Myles Garrett, he may have played his last game of the season.
Now what I did was foolish, and I shouldn't have allowed myself to slip like that. That's out of character.
All right, so Myles Garrett called it foolish. I would say it's something on the other end of the spectrum, the behavior you saw there, and I'm sure there was an element, some will say, well, being in the moment, that still makes no excuse for what actually happened. How long do you think, Nick, should Myles Garrett be suspended for?
I think Baker understood the gravity of it far better than Myles Garrett did. He'll be suspended the rest of the year. I'd be shocked if it's shorter. I would be not shocked, but quite surprised if it goes longer than that.
Into next season?
Yeah, I think six games is, I think it'll be a regular season suspension. I think it'll be six games. I don't think the Browns are going to make the playoffs at this point, so I don't think they're going to have to worry about that part of it. This is the ugliest example of on-field violence since Albert Haynesworth stomped on Andre Girard's face. Now, he got 5 games, but that was also 10 years ago. And I feel like if Haynesworth had done that in 2019, he would have gotten 8 games, 12 games, maybe a full season. To me, this wasn't quite as bad as that, but a lot of that is just good fortune for Myles Garrett, and obviously good fortune for Mason Rudolph because he's the victim here. But the reason that I think it's going to be 6 games and no worse is because Mason Rudolph is okay. And that's just good luck. That's just there. It's not because of how it was swung. It's not because of lack of intent. That could have just as easily, whether it sliced his face or a guy who got knocked out cold earlier this year, which is why we saw Duck Hodges playing. If this would have knocked him out, then I think the penalty would have been far more severe. And one could argue, well, it's the intent that matters, not the result, but that's not how we adjudicate anything in sports or in real life.
But like, then doesn't that set precedent that, oh, if you hit someone with a helmet, it's going to be 6 games, or would it be the remainder of the season?
Well, no. Listen, by the way, there is Antonio Smith swung a helmet and hit Richie Incognito. He got three games. And so, I mean, to me, 6 feels right, sounds right, and there's 6 games left in the season. There's not always a rhyme or reason, Danny, to NFL discipline. I don't think Myles Garrett will play again for the Cleveland Browns until next year.
I think that's too harsh. I really do. I look at this, like, and I want to come back at you because I want to say, what are you going to do with Pouncey then? Because I thought what Pouncey did in defense of his quarterback, goes out there, throws multiple haymakers, not just one swing of the helmet, multiple haymakers and a kick, and then continued punching to get, you know, to defend his quarterback and to get in there and to get in the scrum. So I would say, well, then what are you going to do with Pouncey then on the other side?
I think Pouncey misses two games. I
should never say shocked, but I was genuinely surprised at the amount of players, both current and former, who were saying he's done for the year. He's done for the year. And I think the one precedent that really is not there is Vontaze Burfict. But that was a cheap shot. He had a long history, and he was suspended for the rest of the season, and there were a lot more games left in the season at that point. But I think you have to take into consideration Myles Garrett does not have a lengthy track record of dirty plays. This was more of a reactionary, you know, it shouldn't be overlooked that Mason Rudolph was attacking him. He was on the attack, and Myles Garrett was backing up when he swung it, and then he took the one swing, and then he was down. I'm not making light of the seriousness of the situation, but I look historically, and you mentioned the three games and the other incident where there was a player that swung his helmet. I think three games is probably what he should get, but the NFL has done something. You mentioned what happened with Albert Haynesworth being over a decade ago. The NFL is more reactionary to the public outcry than ever before because they are concerned about what people think of their product. So that from that perspective, I think he might get six games, but I think it's too harsh for what he did on the field.
I think anything Pouncey did is going to be looked at in the prism of a reaction, heat of the moment, a reaction to
why don't you give the same benefit of the doubt for Garrett?
Because Garrett started the whole thing. Because the reason that I think this is worse than Antonio Smith swung his helmet, ripped off Richie Incognito's helmet and swung it at him, hit him in the face, got three games. And Antonio Smith and Richie Incognito had been going back and forth all game. Richie Incognito is who he is. Antonio Smith, tough guy too. And it felt like those two guys both, their actions led to the moment, if you will. This is vintage 2019 Cleveland Browns in this regard. The game is over. You actually have a good quality win, and Myles Garrett unnecessarily first stupid action or bad action takes Mason Rudolph to the ground after the play when the game's over.
Yeah.
Or maybe one more play. You don't need to do that. That's the first thing. The second thing is they're on the ground. Mason Rudolph is trying to get his helmet off. He rips Mason's helmet off because he's going to win that. He's going to win that, you know, tete-a-tete. That's the second bad action. And then the third one is the one that, again, is why this is a huge deal. After, I would argue, making two bad decisions, he goes over the top of all of them and with an almost a roundhouse to the top of the head. And that's going to get you suspended more right now in this moment, not just because you can say the NFL's reactionary, but it's also the NFL has made a concerted effort to make the whole world know they care about the safety of their players. I don't think he would have gotten six games, by the way, and he hasn't gotten it. Just
right.
If he swung it sideways and hit him in the ribs.
No,
I think it's the fact that you hit the dude in the head with the item that's supposed to protect his head. I think in an era of concussions and player safety, that's going to play terribly in the league office, and I think it probably should.
And all of this, thankfully, thank goodness, for football, for the NFL, for everybody, the worst case didn't happen. Because you meant we can't even overlook the fact that Mason Rudolph, the concussion that he did suffer not that long ago, was one of the most painful looking, scary moments that we've seen in the NFL in some time. So thankfully they avoided that. But I do agree with you. That's one thing where I think three games would be appropriate, but I'm kind of leaning towards, all right, the masses are crying for six games. The seriousness that the NFL wants to portray them, you know, hey, going out there and taking care of taking putting a priority on player safety, setting a tone, this cannot happen.
Which is why I think the NFL overcompensates, which is why I think the NFL says, we never want to see this again. Fights are going to happen. Scuffles are going to happen. Mm-hmm. Never want to see a player take a helmet off and swing. Anything could have happened. We're very lucky it didn't. Regardless of how healthy Mason Rudolph is this morning, I think we go above and beyond. I think it's all this year and maybe even bleeding into next year in some way to set some semblance of precedent. This is never going to be tolerated in the NFL. I just think they overcompensate a little bit rather than maybe undercompensate because of either fan reaction or because Mason Rudolph is
I've
okay
today.
I've
seen this happen a lot in practice before. When you see in training camp, there's always scrums and it's teammates going against each other. And typically, when there is a helmet that is used as a weapon, that's the minute everybody jumps in and breaks it up.
Yeah,
that
because by the way, this happens at practice
all the time.
Maybe not the quarterback getting bonked on the head, but the helmet being used as a weapon, we see in practice fights and sometimes those inter-team scrimmages in training camp. You don't see it in the game.
What do you think, Nick, about what Baker had to say, calling this absolutely inexcusable just minutes after it happened?
I find this is very interesting because this is going to be, I believe, the thing that Baker has done this year that plays the best on shows like this and the worst in his locker room. I think a lot of the things Baker has done this year that on shows like this we criticize, complaining about the refs, for example, talking to the fans, I think that plays fine in the locker room. I think a lot of those guys agree with them. Man, the refs are out to get us. And man, it is too loud. And we kill them for it. This, he is going to be Baker finally showed maturity.
Right.
Baker called out a teammate in the heat of the moment. And by the way, all that's true. I think in the locker room, I don't think it plays that well. I think in the locker room, I don't think he's killed for it. But I think that Myles Garrett clearly did not understand the gravity of the situation. Baker, in the moment, is saying it's inexcusable, it overshadows the win, it's awful, it's dangerous, all these things. And so I do wonder, and you can speak to this better than I can, Danny, if in that locker room there's going to be some guy saying, hey, Baker, you didn't have to say anything, man. I was on the sideline. I didn't see exactly what happened. I know it got ugly. I hope everyone's okay. We got the win. We're moving forward. So I think Baker's going to be applauded for it by members of the press.
Just not by members of his
team. And not by members of his
team. I think if it wasn't so, you know, unanimously criticized, that I think his teammates will give him a pass.
All right, let's move on to Sunday's big matchup. Ravens versus Texans. Dual threat quarterback versus dual threat quarterback. Lamar Jackson, with an MVP within reach, has his Ravens team on a 5-game win streak, while Deshaun Watson has quietly carried Houston to first place in the AFC South. Nick, it's an easy question. Might not be an easy answer. Who's got the edge Sunday?
The Baltimore Ravens in every aspect other than quarterback. And that's no shot at Lamar. Right. I just think Deshaun right now is a tick or two better than Lamar week in, week out, while Lamar can flash to be the best player in the league at times. On any given week, I expect A-minus to A-level quarterbacking from Deshaun. I expect B-plus to A-minus level quarterbacking from Lamar. But in every other box you want to check, it is the Ravens by far. They have one of the greatest kickers ever. They have one of the best coaches in the NFL. The Texans, I would argue, have one of the worst coaches in the NFL. The Ravens have a defense that at the beginning of the year wasn't really fully together. They then trade for Marcus Peters. They get Jimmy Smith back. Earl Thomas gets more familiar with what they're doing there. That defense is scary now. The Texans' defense getting worse. J.J. Watt, done for the season. We know the Ravens have a better offensive line, even with the Texans' addition of Laremy Tunsil. And, oh yeah, by the way, where's this football game? Oh, it's in Baltimore. So for all those reasons, I feel like the Baltimore Ravens are a Super Bowl contender. I feel like the Houston Texans are a playoff contender. And so for all those reasons, I think Baltimore has the clear-cut edge almost across the board in this football game.
I agree with you. I think the Baltimore Ravens also have something that's just special and unique in their offense, combined with Lamar Jackson, with Mark Ingram, with their scheme that Greg Roman is designing, that's actually utilizing these things. I agree with you across the board, because I do think Deshaun Watson as a passer clearly has an advantage in years, experience, and success, what he's actually done to this point. What I think is going to be interesting, I think you and I are both on the same page as far as liking the Ravens in this game, is that both teams are pretty good defensively against the run. And that could put more onus on the pass game with these quarterbacks. And yet, when you're talking about the most dominant run game in the NFL, I think that would still be a bigger challenge for the Texans to slow down the Ravens in any aspect there. So I still think the Ravens will run the ball successfully.
And listen, the Texans have had a nice season so far. They have a great win over Kansas City. Deshaun, they almost had a great win in week one against New Orleans that ended up being squandered at the very end. However, their next 3 weeks are really, really difficult. They play Baltimore, an Indy team that's already beaten them, and then New England. We are going to, if I'm wrong that they are just a playoff contender, that they are in fact a Super Bowl contender, they can go prove that this week. If they win this week, they finish this week looking like the 2 seed in the AFC, because they'll be 7-3, the Ravens will be 7-3, and they will have that critical head-to-head tiebreaker. And that's something the Texans franchise has never had, a bye in the first round. This is a team that, since they came back to Houston, has never been past the second round of the postseason. They clearly believe they can this year. You don't trade between August 1st and right now. They have traded away 2 number 1s, a number 2, and 2 number 3s, as far as draft picks, for players currently on the roster, for guys they want right now to help them win right now. They believe we're in this window. Deshaun's on his rookie deal. DeAndre, they thought they were still going to have J.J. Watt, obviously. The only outgoing talent they had was Clowney, which was a move I didn't understand, but they thought Merciless and Watt would be enough. So the Texans believe they are in that top tier of the AFC with New England, with Baltimore, with Kansas City, if you still include Kansas City in there. I do not. I think the Texans are a bit of a one-man show in Deshaun Watson and his connection with the receiving corps, so one man plus his weapons. And then everything else on the team is a question mark. I wouldn't be shocked if Indy ends up winning this division over Houston because of the next few weeks. They can prove me wrong, though, with a win this week. This would be a spectacular win. Arguably, the single best win of the Bill O'Brien era in Houston would be this week in Baltimore.
Well, I was going to get to that because their offseason was a bit of a mess when they fired their GM. It was very odd. And then they make all these deals after that. It did feel like this was a make or break season for Bill O'Brien. And yet, once again, Deshaun Watson is the guy carrying a lot of that load, covering up for anything. You know, he cleans up a lot, right? Mm-hmm. He's gonna make your team that much better. I would ask you, is it similar to sort of what you're saying about the Browns yesterday, even the Cowboys, to some extent, if you miss the playoffs, would it be better in the long run for Deshaun Watson if they did go in a different direction? Because he's had, you know, Freddie Kitchens is a one-year wonder. You know, we're still figuring him out. You already know what you're getting with Bill O'Brien.
Listen, for some reason or another, ownership in Houston, whether it's the late Bob McNair or his son Cal McNair, are just intoxicated with Bill O'Brien. It's not that he is on the hot seat. It's that he has gotten a premature contract extension before last season. And this season, he became arguably the second most powerful head coach in the entire NFL behind only his mentor, Bill Belichick.
They don't even have
Belichick.
A GM, right?
Right. It's he and the former team chaplain for the Patriots that are making the decisions. That's the true story. That are making the decisions for the Texans. So, no, I don't think, even if they turn 6-3 into 9-7 or 8-8, I don't think he gets fired. So, for them, it's not losing is better for you because I don't think there's any systemic changes in Houston if they lose. And by the way, they have shown at their best they can be really good, mm-hmm. but the lack of consistency week to week and the in-game decision-making, Harbaugh understands the math, embraces the math, goes with it. Bill O'Brien is still on the old abacus.
Cool.
And
yeah.
So it's I think that's a huge mismatch this weekend.
All right, on to the Steelers and the Browns in a game that'll be remembered for little else other than this horrific mess in the waning seconds of the game. Mason Rudolph and Myles Garrett in a scuffle. Garrett will rip off Rudolph's helmet, strike him in the head with it, and all that brawl ensues. Players running in from the sideline. Garrett and two others were ejected. Browns won, but nobody was talking about that afterwards. Here's Freddie Kitchens after the game.
I never okayed fights. Did you say I okayed fights? I never okayed fights. Did I want them to get after their ass? Yes, I did. But that's not fighting. That's not after the whistle. But that's between the whistles, yes. I never condone fighting on a football field because that's penalties. I don't coach penalties. I don't coach false starts. I don't coach after the whistle grabbing somebody's face mask. I don't coach that.
All right, well, shy of the face mask part, all those things have happened in almost every game. There have been penalties, and it's been whistle after whistle and undisciplined behavior from this team the whole season. Obviously, it escalated with what happened last night. Do you think the Browns, Nick, their lack of discipline is on head coach Freddie Kitchens?
I don't put it solely on Freddie Kitchens because this is who they were last year. But Freddie Kitchens didn't put a stop to it. There's a very interesting moment in your favorite show, Hard Knocks, Jenna, where Todd Haley, my old friend Todd Haley, who once was the offensive coordinator there, gets into it with Greg Williams because it was the defensive coordinator. and then the interim head coach. Because during practice, they're committing penalties after the play, hitting the quarterback after the play. And Haley's furious, and he and Greg Williams go at it. And then in that week's episode, in the preseason game that week, they're trying to get off the field to stay alive in the preseason game, and there is a post-snap penalty on the Cleveland defense, and Haley, they cut to Haley, and he goes, well, we practice it, we deserve it, this is who we are. And that is who they were last year, and that is who they've been this year, and nobody has been able to get a hold of it. Myles Garrett, I don't think he has a history of this, but in the first game of the year, he got fined for an illegal hit. In the second game of the year, he had multiple late hits, one of which broke Trevor Siemian's leg. Another play not that dissimilar to the beginning of this one, where you're taking a guy down that you don't have to take down. He is what you call an edge player. And it is hard to be a great pass rusher without being an edge player because of the nature of the position. But if you were to tell me, but you know, blind reveal, there's going to be a team this week that in the waning moments of a game has a totally unnecessary melee, I would either guess the Raiders just because of the 35-year history, even if that's not who they've been this year, or the Browns, because they have shown a shocking lack of discipline year over year. It is on a head coach to get a hold of it. It's one of the reasons I think Freddie Kitchens isn't the right guy for the job, because he has not been able to, Danny. I don't place the blame for this solely on him, but because it was trending this way, but he wasn't able to put a stop to it the way maybe a more seasoned or veteran head coach could have.
I think it's totally unfair to put this incident on Freddie Kitchens. The lack of discipline across the board where they have so many penalties throughout the season, that is absolutely fair, because as the head coach, you are responsible for the culture. And the culture that transpires in practice, in the locker room, in an offseason, it becomes contagious so that it creeps onto the game field. So there obviously is a problem with this team and a lack of discipline. So from that standpoint, I get that Freddie Kitchens is defensive because it was asked about this specifically, but overarching, he's got to take more accountability for this team's lack of discipline.
And what about the fact that even if we don't hold Freddie Kitchens accountable at all for the end of the play, what about holding him accountable or the team as a whole accountable for the beginning of the play? Because it is an undisciplined team that in a game that you have won, that your best defensive player would think it is at all reasonable when the ball is clearly out of the quarterback's hands to take him to the ground for no reason whatsoever. If you want to make the argument in the first quarter of a game against a divisional rival, you'll risk a 15-yard penalty to send a message to the opposing team's quarterback. I know the league wouldn't like hearing that, but that is kind of football. There is an element of sometimes 15 yards is worth letting the other guy know, I'm going to be here all day long. There's 8 seconds left in this football game. The game is over. You're up 2 scores. And it all started because Myles Garrett took him to the ground unnecessarily. That is something that has to be coached out of guys. And you don't see, and I hate to use the cliche, you don't see the New England Patriots doing this.
No, of course not.
Well, you don't see teams that have it together, forget the end, doing the things that led to the beginning of this.
I think the opposite of undisciplined, obviously, is discipline. But I do think the opposite of undisciplined is a smart football team. And that's where I would say this Browns team is not very smart, because I do think there is a time when you can take those risks and it's worth it to get a penalty on a quarterback, make him hear ghosts or footsteps throughout the game. But this was not one of those times. And I think that's why even his own teammates, when Baker was calling him out, when his coach is calling him out, it is not a very smart play, because it's going to have much bigger ramifications on whether this team can actually make the unlikely playoff run that I thought they could. And now it's in doubt.
And then Danny, you and I were just talking this morning. Last week's game, Browns come out, they score a touchdown. Jarvis Landry, wonderful. Instead of just having an extra kick, yaps his mouth off, undisciplined. Now they're thrown all the way back and they miss the extra point. It's something small, but it was discipline at the end of the game. It's discipline right off the top. If there's no accountability on the team, then you're going to keep having this. I think that comes from the head coach.
It does. That's the culture you're talking about. And it does start in practice, in details, and some of the stuff that coaches, and I've played in a lot of organizations, they have little rules rules that they will implement throughout, you know, the locker room. And sometimes it's as simple as what your locker should look like. Should you clean up the, you know, should you clean up the mess around your locker? Or if you have a penalty at practice, do you get punished for it? Some teams, the bad teams that I played for, would let it slide. Oh, well, he'll take care of that during a game, or you get a talking to. Other ones, there would be more significant punishment. Maybe if there was a fight that broke out at practice, not only those players would have to run, but the entire team would have to run. There are ways you can coach these out of these players.
And last, Freddie Kitchens feels the heat. If you, he was one of the most interesting things in that press conference right there was he said, I don't coach false starts. Bro, ain't nobody talking about false starts right now. But he clearly has heard the criticism about how penalized they are. Like, I'm going to play pop psychologist for a moment. He knows the criticism, how penalized the Browns have been prior to the last few weeks, knows that's fallen on him, and I guarantee you he said in some of these private conversations, man, they're blaming me for the false starts. It's my fault that our left guard can't stay in his stance, and it came out there because what was supposed to be his best win, his second best win.
No one's even
coach,
talking about it.
Nobody cares. And instead, the most talented defensive player on your team, a guy who was still alive for Defensive Player of the Year, yep, is not going to play for at least the next month, if not longer.
You know where this would never happen? In New England. Patriots, they're coming off their bye week, which came off their first loss of the season. They will face the Eagles Sunday. It's a rematch of Super Bowl 52. Eagles won that game. Patriots lost. Guess who can't move past it? Tom Brady said he still thinks about it to this day. The Eagles are home underdogs in what some are calling a must-win. Nick, does Philly pull off the upset against the Patriots?
Before I answer that question, Jenna Wolf, I would like to ask you a question. What did I say before the Baltimore game? Who was going to win that game?
The Ravens.
And I said the Patriots in their next five games were going to lose how many? Do you remember?
Was it three?
Three. They're going to lose three out of five. That they were going to be 13-3, still the one seed, but they were going to have three losses in their next five. This is loss number two at Philly this weekend. I don't know why one would believe the Patriots should be the favorite in this game, other than the Eagles' level of inconsistency throughout the season. Carson Wentz has not had the year I expected him to have. He is still having a better year than Tom Brady. And Tom Brady, by the way, if you look at what he's done and this passing game has done post the first 3 weeks of the season, which even though New England had a soft opening 8 weeks, those first 3 weeks, you have Pittsburgh, which was a team that was not the defense they are now at all, didn't have Minka, they had Devin Bush was not the player he is, and then most importantly, Miami and the Jets. Since then, Tom Brady's got 7 touchdowns, 5 picks, and 83 passer rating, which would be 26th in football. Since then, they also have shown this team can be run on. And as you've talked about, Danny, the last couple weeks, that's where Philadelphia has finally started to find their footing running the football. I think the Patriots are a great pass defense, and that is where right now the greatness ends with this team, aside from Bill Belichick and coaching and the legacy of Tom Brady. The pass offense has not been great. The run defense has not been great. The special teams, from a kicking game perspective, have been a mess because Gostkowski's out for all those reasons and because Philly needs this game a hell of a lot more than New England, and they're at home. I like Philadelphia. I think New England loses two in a row.
I think there is no way the Patriots lose two in a row. You're talking about Bill Belichick, Tom Brady, two of the greatest competitors this game has ever seen, with a week to prepare, a bye week to get healthy, to start game planning and steaming and boiling and letting this stew, there is no way they come out.
And the revenge factor.
The revenge factor to the last time. That's probably overplayed somewhat, but you combine all of that plus, and I do think the Patriots were, I don't want to say overrated because that sounds like a knock, but when their defense was being talked about as potentially the greatest of all time, I thought that was a little bit of hyperbole, right? They weren't, and it was propped up by their schedule, but I do think they are still an elite defense this year in the NFL, and I do think they will have a time. Because I also think it wasn't that long ago, and it's amazing how winning can change a narrative, it can change everything in a locker room, it can change legacies, it can change the way you perceive quarterbacks. It was not that long ago, and I actually thought that this team would come together because some of the criticism that was coming from the team. But there were, you know, rumors in the locker room. Oh, is Carson Wentz a leader? And, you know, Lane Johnson's calling out guys that are late for practice. You got former players and Orlando Scandrick calling out the team. This team was a little bit of a mess. And for that reason, not It's just the inconsistency with this Eagles team has been there, and that's why it's really hard for me to trust them in this spot. Even though they're at home, and the Patriots, I do think, are not as good or great as everybody thinks they are, I think this is a game where the Patriots get back on track.
Tom Brady went on to say both teams have seen a lot of changes over the last 2 years. How different are these two teams? I mean, we know that the Patriots defense is obviously playing as well as, well, it depends. So it depends what you think of their opposition. But how much have these two teams changed since the last time they played?
Oh, to me, these are as different as two teams can be a couple years removed. I mean, the Patriots, you look at the key components of that Super Bowl run, aside from Brady, Belichick, and Edelman, that team has turned over almost entirely. Gilmore was there already at that point, so you had some of your key cogs, but Gronk's obviously not there. The offensive line has changed. The kicker has changed. They've had 45 different wide receivers walk through the door in that time. The Eagles, on the other hand, are a drastically different football team from personnel and from mentality. They were much better as the hunter than as the hunted, and they are still trying to find their footing there. But you mentioned Belichick and Brady coming off a bye. It's just how the schedule fell. Philly's also coming off a bye. Philly also is coming off what I would consider its best two games of the season, aside from the Green Bay game. And I mentioned the Green Bay game on purpose. Philly has shown an ability, at least once this year, to beat a great opponent. New England has played two teams that would currently qualify for the postseason. Buffalo, who they beat by the skin of their teeth on a blocked punt, was the difference in that football game. And Baltimore, who whooped them. This, to me, Philly is the second best team they will have faced all year. I think Philly's better than Buffalo, even though Buffalo is the better record. And I think this game being in Philadelphia plays to their strengths greatly.
2 weeks, people have been telling the Patriots, oh, you were propped up by the schedule. I'm telling you, that will not bode well for the Eagles, because the Patriots are going to come out very fired up. But one thing we didn't even mention about the last time they played, Was Carson Wentz the quarterback in that Super Bowl? I mean, that obviously is really important.
They haven't faced Carson Wentz.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, that's a massive difference between those. And it's one of the most impressive things about Tom Brady. It's why there really is no debate about who is the GOAT. How many different players that he's lifted up and brought to Super Bowls. It's amazing what he's been able to do.
Patriots could get N'Keal Harry in the lineup in the game this Sunday. So
I'm excited to see him play.
Yeah, me too.
Nick, how long do you think Myles Garrett should be suspended for?
I think you're right. I think it's six games. I think it's
because that's the remainder.
It's nice and clean that the rest of the schedule is six games, because this felt like, given the precedent of incidents similar to this, it feels like six games would have been just about right, whether there was four games left in the year or 14 games left in the year. And I know we're going to get to Baker's comments on it later in the segment, but Baker seemed to understand the gravity a lot better than Myles Garrett did after the game. I look to incidents. You see stuff like this in practice fights quite often, actually. I shouldn't say quite often, but it's not, maybe not making contact, but the swinging of a helmet you see in practice fights. As far as in a game, Antonio Smith, who I covered once, a really interesting, actually nice guy off the field, but a tough dude on the field, he swung Richie Incognito's helmet at him horizontally, not over the top, hit him across the face lightly, if you will, kind of grazed him. He got three games. And that was 6 years ago, 7 years ago. To me, this is the worst, Brian, incident of on-field violence post-play since Albert Haynesworth stomped on Andre Girard's face. Now, I think what Haynesworth did was more heinous than this, and you might say, well, he only got five games. That was also a decade ago.
Yep.
The world's changed a lot in a decade in a multitude of different ways, the NFL being at the forefront of that, of legitimately caring about player safety and, to your point, legitimately caring about the optics of these things. So, I don't think he's going to be banished from the league. I certainly don't think he's going to be arrested for aggravated assault, as some crazy people have speculated. But I do think the rest of the year seems about right in the context of 2019.
Well, he'll definitely be suspended for the rest of the season. Six games, it sounds like. It's easy. It may be even more. You know, this is a terrible situation. It's a terrible look for the league. It's egregious, and it's inexcusable, and it's undisciplined. And this football team has been undisciplined all season long. I'll push back a little bit on the practice stuff and the swinging of the helmet. I've been a part of training camp fights where John Runyan has ripped off the helmet, and he didn't swing it. He threw it into the stands, but he didn't swing it at another player. And there were so many times in this situation where Myles Garrett could have said, you know what, my discipline is going to kick in. I got him down on the ground, a little bit of a late hit. Now my discipline should kick in. That didn't happen. Now I'm going to rip off his helmet. My discipline should have kicked in at that point. That didn't happen. Now I'm getting pushed back by the opposing players, and I have the helmet in my hand, and I could have just dropped the helmet. My discipline didn't kick in at that point, and you end up swinging it, and you see what happened at the end of the play. At some point, the discipline from the head coach over the practice, over the camp, over the course of the season has to kick in, and it never kicked in for Myles Garrett. That just shows me that there's no discipline
there
in
is
the
none.
Football
there's
team.
There's nothing to kick in
that's
here from
a,
the head
that's
coach.
That's a major
down.
Problem. That's why the Browns lead the league in players getting ejected. That's a problem. This is a Freddie Kitchens problem, just as big as it is a Myles Garrett problem.
I think just real quick, I think your point that Myles had so many exit ramps off this is a really important one, that it didn't even have to start because it started on a late hit with 10 seconds left in the damn football game. And then there were so many times where he could have ended this, and it is a footnote to the game instead of the game being a footnote to the fight.
I think you guys are being too harsh. I look at Myles, and I'm not excusing this. I'm not saying it shouldn't be taken seriously by the league, but I think there's a couple things that we can look at. I don't think it was a cheap shot. Like Vontaze Burfict, when he got suspended, long track record. Myles Garrett does not have a lengthy track record of dirty, cheap shots. So I think he has that going for him. One, I think he was contrite after the game. He wasn't defending it. He was saying, I don't know if I'm going to get suspended. So I think he is contrite. The other thing is, does anybody else, you know, get like Mason Rudolph was the one who kept perpetuating this fight, was chasing after him. It could have easily de-escalated if Mason Rudolph just backs away and just lets him go. And then you have normal quarterbacks would do that, right? You don't want to jeopardize your career. If you swing at him, you hit his helmet, you could break your hand and you don't get to play anymore. So I do think for a couple of those reasons, the NFL could look at this and say there is a precedent before, as you mentioned, with Antonio Smith, the three games that he had. I think three to four games, I think would be more than adequate to send a message. But I also think what's going to be really interesting, what does Pouncey get? What if some of the other guys who were ejected as well? Because I think they're just as culpable for having this melee unfold
just
in this
game. Just as culpable as Myles Garrett?
I do. I mean, he was being, Mason Rudolph was going after him and pursuing him when he took the helmet and made that hit. Yeah, I think that has to come into play.
Real quick.
That's why I don't think it's a fight. There are no rules in fighting.
In theory, Danny, I understand what you're saying, but in practice, that's not how the world ever works.
Right.
If I keep, you're bigger than me. People think I'm a tiny guy. I'm not, but you're a big guy. If I after the show, I'm like, and I keep talking trash to you, and I get in your face, and I just keep, you know, like almost daring you to hit me.
Like you do on
and
Twitter.
Yeah, exactly right. And you overhand write me.
Right.
Even if I was the instigator, even if I could have walked
away. You're in the
wrong
no matter what.
And by the way, if after you overhand write me, Brian Westbrook and Dusty come over and attack you because you've knocked me down, they are, even if in a vacuum, well, you know, he threw a punch, that's going to be looked at so differently. Because the one moment here that is seemingly bigger than all the others combined would have been yours, even if that's not really fair. But you know what's also not totally fair is that David DeCastro tried to block the helmet. Mm-hmm. Myles Garrett's intent would have been no different. If he blocked it, this is not a big deal. Maybe he suspended one game. Conversely, if the helmet hits him differently, if a guy who has already suffered a terrible concussion this year, if he gets knocked out by this,
this is also
then we
different.
Are talking about maybe a full 16-game file for reinstatement type of suspension. If the helmet, one of the rivets, cuts across his face and he's bleeding, like what actually helped Myles Garrett to me here, Brian, is that Mason's response was, what the hell did you just do? Threw his arms up and not falling down, not being seriously injured by it.
By the way, Mason Rudolph was the one who went for his helmet first.
But he wasn't successful at it.
Right, but yeah. That doesn't make it any better.
Yeah, Garrett should have stopped at some point. I think Pouncey ends up getting suspended for all of the punches that he just threw for a couple games. You just wonder what goes through a player's mind. At some point, you say, well, you have to stop. The other part is that where's these guys at? Where are the other guys that say, you know what, let's go get the one guy that can help us save our season? Because throughout that football game, Myles Garrett was the reason that Mason Rudolph had trouble. He couldn't move around in the pocket, couldn't do a lot of things. Because Myles Garrett was harassing the entire football game. Where's his guys that are saying, let's save our star defensive player. Let's help him. They couldn't get there quick enough. It's certainly disappointing to see this happen in the game. But at some point, drop the helmet, allow the play to go on. It's the end of the football game. He didn't see it.
Nick, what do you think about what
Baker Mayfield had to say on the field just moments after this happened to have the discipline and the wherewithal to be able to say, hey, let me put this in perspective. This was inexcusable.
I think this is going to, the way this plays out, I'm very curious because I think this is going to show the dichotomy, the split between the media that cover the game and the people that actually play it. This is going to be, of all Baker's comments this season, the one I think most applauded by the media and the one met with the most skepticism in his locker room. I think that when Baker came out and said, man, the refs, I'm going to get fined, I don't care, free speech, all that nonsense. Every show like this one was like, Baker, grow up. And my guess is, in the locker room, especially amongst young players, they probably were like, damn, I'm glad he said something, stick up for us. He's going to be applauded for, in the heat of the moment right after, saying it's inexcusable, it can't happen, by folks like us. And I think in the locker room, guys, tell me if you think I'm wrong, I think guys are going to say, man, you didn't have to say that. Like, you just, I didn't see it. I don't know. I hate that it happened. Got to watch the tape. You know, Miles, my teammate. Mason's my friend. Like, I don't think this will play great amongst his teammates.
Well, I think you're wrong. I think that it will play great with the media. I think a lot of people will say
Baker
is taking responsibility. He's saying the right things. But I think in the locker room, the guys understand that as well. We have a chance to make a playoff run. We have a chance to make a playoff push. And this probably ends that push. And so they're upset about the undisciplined plays over the course of the entire season, not just here. And Baker showed that his uncomfortableness, his leadership in that moment. But he also is saying this is not something new. This is something that has happened all season long. And I think not only Baker, but the guys in the locker room are certainly disappointed about that as well.
I think it's a very mature moment for Baker Mayfield, something he hasn't displayed of a lot of maturity in his young career. I think this was a very mature statement. And I do think, like, we can disagree on the length of the suspension, but no one is disagreeing of the seriousness and the gravity of the moment. And I think even in that locker room, those guys were astounded at what unfolded at the end of that game.
I just wonder that if this ends up being longer than any of us expect, if he gets 8 games, if it goes into next season,
I think it's going into next season.
And Jenna does think that. And listen, people have speculated that. Then do people in the locker room who maybe are angry at Myles Garrett now, but if they think he's overpunished, then all of a sudden do they start to wonder, did Baker add to it by right after the game as the leader of the football team seemingly being as horrified as everyone else? Did he unintentionally add fuel to the fire? I don't think that'll be fair, by the way, if people feel that way, but guys in a locker room are not always the most rational human beings, and you get a little territorial. It's us against the world. I just wonder how it plays.
How quickly do you think this comes down? Today?
Oh, I think I don't know about today, but before Sunday kickoff.
Yes.
We'll have.
Absolutely.
All right. I just don't know when I can tell you guys I was right. I don't know if it's tomorrow. It's probably not going to be. Back here with Brian Westbrook talking Sunday's big matchup between the Ravens and the Texans, between one dual threat quarterback and another dual threat quarterback, between Lamar Jackson with an MVP in his reach and his Ravens team on a 5-game win streak, and Deshaun Watson, who's carried Houston to first place in the AFC South. This is going to be a good one. Nick, let's start with you. Who's got the edge on Sunday?
I think the Ravens, because I think they're better in every area except quarterback. And the
and obviously head coach. That was a joke. That was a joke.
And by the way, I don't think the gap in quarterback's enormous. I think Lamar's played to that level. But I think it's really interesting, Jenna, what you said, that Lamar's got an MVP within reach. If I'm wrong, if the Texans win this game, I think you're going to start hearing Deshaun Watson's name associated with the MVP conversation a lot more.
It's been the way the MVP conversation has gone all year.
All
it's
year
great,
long.
Great.
Like the only one who's really been there starting in week two in the top three the whole time is Russell.
It's Russell Wilson.
And he's deserved to be, by the way. But after a couple weeks, it was Russell and Patrick Mahomes. Then it felt like it was Russell and Aaron Rodgers. Then it was Russell and Lamar Jackson.
Christian McCaffrey
occasionally makes an appearance. And if the Texans pull off what I would consider not only a major upset, but it would be, and this is a bit of an indictment on Bill O'Brien's tenure, the single best win of Bill O'Brien's career with the Texans. He has like two legitimately quality road victories out of division. This would be the best of them all. I just don't think they have the horses to do it. And even if they do, I think Harbaugh is as good as anyone in the league, including Belichick, at understanding modern football. Time, score, situation, two-point conversions, fourth downs, how to give yourself an analytical edge. And Bill O'Brien does not. to say the least. And so for all those reasons, I really like Baltimore in this
game. I'm glad you brought that up, because when John Harbaugh was our special teams coach, the one thing that he always talked about was situational football. If you're down three and you need a field goal, do you do this? If you're down two, do you go for two-point conversions?
Well,
and that speaks to what he does as a head coach as well. I certainly give the edge to the Ravens. I think having a home game, I don't think anyone in the NFL has figured out the ball handling, what's going on in the backfield with Lamar Jackson, Mark Ingram. I don't know if anybody can figure out who has the ball at any time. They have two guys in the backfield that can be explosive runners in Ingram and Jackson, and they go in different ways. The defense is guessing. They're actually thinking, and that's the one thing that you don't want as a player, is to sit there and try to think of what's going to happen, because you can't react the way that you want to do naturally. And so this is what happens for the Texans, for them to win. DeSean Jackson has to be special. DeSean Watson has to be special. He has the ability to be special,
yep.
But I like the Ravens secondary. I like Jimmy Smith. I like Humphreys. I like Marcus Peters. I like Earl Thomas. Those guys are together, are really, really tough to play against. And so that's why I give the edge to the Ravens.
DeSean Watson is a better passer, but it kind of crosses each other out, because Lamar Jackson is a clearly better runner than DeSean Watson. And again, the margin is very slim between these two quarterbacks. I think the Texans have the edge at wide receiver, but that is about it. And you mentioned, where does anybody know where the ball is going? What about the Heisman formation that they just debuted last week? I still think they have more that they haven't shown, and they are saving it for the latter portion of the season. And they're just wrinkling it. They're putting them in.
RG3's going to throw that ball at some point.
Exactly, he is. And they're going to have a throwback to Lamar. And they're going to have all types of unique, innovative ideas that are going to give defensive coordinators fits. I think all across the board, except for quarterback, which is marginal, and receiver, you give it to the Texans. I think it's clearly the Ravens have the edge.
Well, and one other note. Prior to the Week 9 game for the Texans against the Fighting Gardner Minshews, their pass defense had been abysmal. So for context, DeSean Watson, the Texans quarterback this year, 18 touchdowns, 5 picks, a 107 rating. Every quarterback against the Texans cumulatively prior to Week 9, 18 touchdowns, 3 picks, a 105 rating. So they were turning their opposition into DeSean Watson each and every week before they faced Minshew. And now you have Lamar, who's playing at the level that he is. I don't think the Texans' pass defense, particularly with no J.J. Watt for the rest of the year, is going to be able to slow down this Ravens offense enough.
But how much does it help their defense, and actually the Ravens' defense as well, that both play in practice with a dual-threat quarterback, that both play in practice with a quarterback who's a mirror of the quarterback they're going to face on Sunday? Does that help their defenses?
Well, I think it helps them a little bit, but just like everyone says, you can never duplicate that type of speed that you'll see with Lamar Jackson. You'll never be able to duplicate his elusiveness, his ability to make guys miss. You can't duplicate that in practice. You just don't have that guy on your team. If you had that guy, he would be playing offense for you. He would be getting it done on the offensive side of the ball. So no matter how much you practice it, it's kind of like, those teams that play against Army and the Navy. They don't know what's going on with the wishbone, the wing tee. They can't figure it out in the 7 days in between games. The same type of thing happens with Lamar Jackson. Here's the other thing, and I think this is the one thing that you have to worry about if you're the Baltimore Ravens. Can Lamar Jackson be accurate enough in his mid and deep passing game? And he has been in the past. This game will tell. Can he be accurate enough to win the game against a great passer in DeSean Watson?
One thing that makes me slightly nervous, the Texans are third in the NFL versus the rush defensively. If they could make them one-dimensional, nobody's been able to do it, can they maintain that? And can they make him one-dimensional, force them to throw the football more? I don't think anybody can. As good as you might be against the rush, there really is no defense, because everybody's accounting for it. Running backs, different formations. No one has a Lamar Jackson.
Jenna, we're going to wake up Monday morning in a position that a month ago would have seemed impossible. Yes, correct. On this show, Monday morning, in a position that no one would have ever thought possible. The Baltimore Ravens will be the one seed in the AFC.
Oh, here he goes. Wow. He's saying the Patriots.
Wow. Well, I don't know if they'll stay there.
Right.
But if the Patriots lose this weekend, Baltimore wins. They're both 8-2. Baltimore's beating them head-to-head. And whatever happens with the Patriots this weekend, if the Ravens win this weekend, they'll not only have given the Texans an extra loss, they'll have the head-to-head tiebreaker with Houston and the head-to-head tiebreaker with New England.
That's crazy.
And be in a brilliant position, at the very least, for a bye in the playoffs, if not the number one seed.
I think Monday we're going to be talking about the show that both these quarterbacks put on. Both of them have an innate ability to rise to the occasion. When the spotlight's on them, their play rises. So I think you're going to see an incredible game back and forth.
All right, Clippers taking on the Pelicans last night. Paul George making his L.A. debut. Lonely night for him without his buddy Kawhi Leonard in the lineup. Why? A little something we like to call load management. PG-13, though, came out, finished with 33 points, 9 rebounds. The Clippers, however, took the loss, 132-127. Nick, is Kawhi costing the Clippers wins with this load management? They're 0-3 without him in the lineup.
This is undeniable that he's costing them wins. Even the people supporting the load management would acknowledge that. Like, the Pelicans were 2-8 and played last night without Lonzo, who hasn't been very good, but also without Brandon Ingram, who's been sensational up to this point this season. And Paul George comes back, gives you 33 and 24 minutes. He was great. He came back earlier from the injury than I suspected, and he looked better immediately than I expected. Credit to him, by the way, who, if we remember correctly, the Los Angeles Clipper this year that was top three in the MVP last year, league-wide, regular season, it's not Kawhi Leonard, it's Paul George, who was top three defensive player of the year voting, top three MVP, something Kawhi Leonard was not. But yeah, he is absolutely unequivocally costing him wins. And I know that the argument is, well, it won't matter if he's better in the postseason because of it, but that's an unknowable. And I know people say last year, well, how can you criticize that he missed 22 games when they won the title? You know who the second most load-managed player in the NBA last year was? Joel Embiid. So I'm just curious, when the Raptors played the Sixers in round two of last year's playoffs, if the Raptors had won, would that also have been a victory for load management? One of those load-managing players was going to win, one was going to lose. But the last point, Danny, and I think it's the one that's most relevant, last year's Raptors, he rested 22 games last year. They lost 5 of them. They were 17-5. He has missed 3 games this year. They've lost all 3 of them. The Clippers do not appear to be nearly as equipped as the Raptors were to deal without Kawhi Leonard.
Because they're not as deep.
They're not as deep.
They don't have the depth there. They're absolutely is costing them games. In the narrative last year, I think load management is getting way too much credit for Kawhi's success in the Raptors championship. First of all, he was still hobbled in the playoffs, and it was a pretty amazing performance by him to fight through the quad injury that he was dealing with. You did have a Warriors team which was decimated as well with injury, so I think it gets too much credit in general, and I think the Clippers are being a little bit too cute with this, and it is going to cost them. And I wonder, do you think there's a scenario where in the back end of the season, this might blow up in their face because they do start looking at, say, hey, we have to pick up the pace a little bit. We do have to start winning games, maybe to get in those top 4 spots or somewhere in there where I think it could backfire on the Clippers.
As an aside, Paul George finished up the game even though he did have 33 points and said he felt terrible, said he felt bad, like he could have done more, said it felt like a preseason game, although his shoulders did feel healthy, which is the takeaway. But he gives you 33-9 on a game where he said he wasn't playing that great. Could he get better enough where Kawhi doesn't have to play all these games?
Listen, where Paul George is talking about is the Clippers as a team were horrific defensively. He had 5 turnovers, and he only played 24 minutes. I'm sure what he's really talking about is Paul George is not here to play 24 minutes. And in those 24 minutes, he was in foul trouble. He had the 5 fouls, and so that was part of it. I don't know exactly what their plan was minutes-wise, but I wonder how much the foul trouble played into it, at least to a degree. But Yeah, Paul George coming back makes it a lot more palatable when Kawhi Leonard misses games. It's why people really started paying attention to this last week. I was on this 2 weeks ago when 4 games into the year he missed a game because I said, hold on, you're going to load manage before Halloween when Paul George is not even there yet. I thought PG might miss 20 games. They said it would be around 10 and it ended up being right around 10. If the Clippers knew that, the fact that Kawhi couldn't deal with it until Paul George got back, that this wasn't the very first game of the year that he missed, or even wait another week until you and Paul George get on the floor together. But yes, it is costing them. And how deep do people think the West is? Because I believe, with no disrespect to the Mavericks or the Spurs or the Suns, who are a really surprising team, I think there are 5 excellent basketball teams in the Western Conference. There's obviously both teams in LA. There's Utah, which added Conley, added Bojan Bogdanovic, had a great offseason. There's Denver, which was the 2 seed last year, that if Jokic gets it going, can be a very dangerous team. And there's Houston, who just beat the Clippers a couple nights ago. 5 teams. One of those teams will be on the road in the first round, and one of those teams will be home after the first round. Go ahead, Dan.
And that's what I was referencing. At the back end of the season, if the Clippers find themselves outside of those top four seeds, do they all of a sudden start to change their methodology and then it all blows up in their face? It just, to me, it's way too early to go with this extreme of the rest.
And I would argue it's not the top four seeds you're worried about. It's the top three. Because if you are four, yeah, you'll have home court, but you're playing one of the five. One of those teams going home in the first round. Before the year, I said I thought it would be the Clippers. Everyone thought it was a take for this The reason I feel that way and felt that way is because we knew Paul George was going to miss time and we knew Kawhi was going to load manage, and the idea that they're just going to be able to roll out of bed come the postseason, and even if I'm wrong that they'd be gone in the first round, they are putting themselves in position where of those five great teams, four and the Clippers, they would have to beat three of them in a series to go to the NBA Finals. Not they don't get the Kings in round one or whomever the seven or the eight seed is. To me, it's damaging and it's risky, and we'll see how it plays out.
Thank you for listening to the First Things First podcast. Remember, leave us a review and tell us what you think. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts and catch us on FS1 Monday through Friday, 6:30 a.m. Eastern.